This is the Practical Teaching Tips Podcast. I am your host, Richard James Rogers, high school science and chemistry teacher and author of the award-winning book, The Quick Guide to Classroom Management. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to today's episode on the Practical Teaching Tips Podcast. I am your host, Richard James Rogers. And as the academic year comes to a close for many of us right now, I often find that this is a time for reflection, a time to reflect upon the kind of strategies we've been using over the course of our students' education, over the past three terms or semesters, whatever you use in your system. And just really, I think it's a good time to really scrutinize what we've been doing as teachers in the classroom. Are the strategies we've been using appropriate? One of the things that has come to mind a lot for me over the past few days is have I really prepared my students well enough for their end-of-year exams? Have I really given them enough guidance with revision? Have my lessons always been as focused as they could be? And as I was preparing for today's podcast episode, I thought that it would be good to shed light on what has become a very popular framework in practical pedagogy, and that is Rosenshine's principles of instruction. I think often as teachers, we can become overwhelmed with all the different strategies that are available to us. There's metacognition, there's assessment for learning, there's accelerated learning strategies, there's feedback strategies, there's all kinds of different ways of thinking about thinking and thinking about education and different ideas for delivering lessons and delivering content appropriately. There's flip learning pedagogy, for example. There's Montessori pedagogy. There's all these different strategies and ideas and tips, frameworks that teachers pick up, especially if you've been teaching for a very long time. There's many CPD sessions, many inset days, many teacher training days, many courses you've probably been on where you've picked up a lot of ideas. Now, I think Rosenshine's is particularly good because it offers teachers a very straightforward, direct framework, I guess is the best word, or methodology to approach every lesson. And I think if I had to choose out of all the strategies available to teachers, if I had to choose just one as my favorite, which I can apply every single lesson, and that would make me a very effective teacher, I think I would choose Rosenshine's principles of instruction. Another reason I really like Rosenshine's is because they kind of merge together old order thinking, which many of us who've been teaching more than 10 years may have picked up in teacher training college. And it merges that with this, the kind of new ideas that are coming out now about cognitive load theory and metacognition and all these different strategies that we're learning about today. It's a very good bridge builder, I think, and it's a very good summary of the things that actually work. So in order to keep this podcast episode really focused for everyone, I'm going to read, as I usually do, a blog post, which goes through 10 ways to apply Rosenshine's principles to your lessons. And this blog post can be found at richardjamesrogers.com. Once again, that's richardjamesrogers.com. And there's a link to this blog post in the episode description if you feel that it's useful and you'd like to share it with your colleagues. So without further ado, let's begin. As a teacher, it's important to have a solid understanding of the principles that underpin effective instruction. One set of principles that has gained widespread recognition is the set proposed by Baruch Rosenshine, a former professor of educational psychology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I hope I've said that properly. In this blog post, we'll explore 10 ways you can apply Rosenshine's principles to your lessons to help your students achieve their full potential. Number 1. Start with a clear objective. According to Rosenshine's principles, the first step in effective instruction is to start with a clear objective. Before you start your lesson, make sure you have a clear understanding of what you want your students to learn. You may wish to use the 3 A's to present objectives to the students via a self-discovery process, and this is very powerful. The 3 A's stand for assign, analyze, and ask. It's a simple 3-step process for starting each lesson, and allows for the teacher to be as creative as he or she wishes when articulating lesson objectives. Number 1 of the 3 A's is to assign a starter activity that links to the topic somehow. This can be as simple as a video playing on the screen as the kids walk in, a worksheet, or even a learning game. The second part of the 3 A's is analyze. Analyze the starter activity. This may involve peer assessing the task, having a class discussion, quick fire questions, or even a true or false activity. And the third part of the 3 A's is to ask the students, what do you think we are learning about today? This may generate some discussion, but if the assign and analyze parts have been designed properly, then it should be obvious what the objectives of the lesson are. For ideas on good starter activities, everyone, there's a blog post that's linked in the blog post that's in this episode description that you can read all about different starter activities. So those are the 3 A's, everyone. Assign, analyze, and ask. Assign a starter activity. Analyze the starter activity and ask the students what they think they are going to learn about in that lesson. And that's the first part of Rosenshine's principles. Make sure there's a clear objective. It's actually still very surprising as I do peer observations and, you know, what I hear from teachers through my blog and through email channels and in my network, just how many lessons do not start with clear objectives. It's absolutely vital. It's something we should all be doing. And I forget from time to time as well. And that's why it's very important, I think, to be vigilant and to keep Rosenshine's principles in mind every lesson. As I said, I think Rosenshine's is probably the best framework that a teacher can carry with them day to day and apply to their lessons every time. So number 2, what's the second way that we can apply Rosenshine's principles? Number 2 is to use a variety of examples. Using a variety of examples is a great way to help your students understand the concepts you're teaching. Use different types of examples, such as visual aids, case studies, or real-life scenarios to help your students better understand the material. Different types of examples can help students to better grasp the concepts being taught, as they provide a range of contexts and perspectives from which to view the material. Visual aids, for instance, can be especially effective in conveying complex information in a way that is easy to understand and remember. Case studies and real-life scenarios, on the other hand, can help students to connect abstract concepts to real-world situations and make the learning experience more meaningful. When selecting examples to use in your lessons, it's important to choose ones that are relevant to your students' interests and experiences. For instance, if you're teaching a science lesson on environmental sustainability, using examples that relate to your students' local community or region can help to make the material more relatable and engaging. Additionally, it's important to use a mix of examples that are both challenging and accessible. Providing examples that are too easy may bore your students and cause them to disengage from the lesson, while using examples that are too difficult can lead to frustration and discouragement. Striking the right balance between challenging and accessible examples can help to keep your students engaged and motivated throughout the lesson. Number 3. Provide guided practice. Guided practice is an effective way to help your students develop their skills and knowledge. Provide your students with opportunities to practice what they've learned, but make sure you are there to guide them through the process. During guided practice, the teacher provides students with guidance and feedback as they work through problems or exercises related to the material being taught. This can help students to develop their skills and knowledge more effectively than if they were simply left to work independently. Guided practice can take many forms, such as structured activities, group work, or one-on-one interactions with the teacher. When implementing guided practice in your lessons, it's important to provide clear instructions and expectations to your students. Make sure they understand what they're supposed to be doing and provide them with any necessary resources or materials. Additionally, it's important to monitor your students' progress and provide feedback along the way, as we mentioned before. This can help them to identify areas where they need to improve and make adjustments accordingly. Finally, it's important to ensure that guided practice is appropriately challenging for your students. Providing practice that is too easy or too difficult can lead to disengagement or frustration. By providing practice that is appropriately challenging, you can help your students to develop their skills and knowledge more effectively. Number 4, use frequent checks for understanding. Frequent checks for understanding can help you gauge how well your students are understanding the material. Use questions, quizzes, or other methods to assist your students' comprehension of the material throughout the lesson. And by the way, these frequent checks for understanding, everybody, it's not quite the same as guided practice. Guided practice, for example, might be where the students are doing a set of past exam paper questions for 30 minutes. Then you're going through the mark scheme with them. And then a frequent check for understanding component might be a live quiz like a Blockit or a Kahoot or a Quizzes or a Quizlet Live or something like that. Some short, snappy quiz that directly assesses the material the students have covered that lesson, ideally, or very, very close to that lesson, like the lesson before or within the same topic. Checks for understanding help to ensure that students are comprehending the material being taught and can identify areas where additional support or instruction may be needed. Frequent checks for understanding can take many forms, such as questions, quizzes, or discussions. By incorporating frequent checks for understanding into your lessons, you can help to ensure that students are engaged and actively learning throughout the lesson. Verbal questions are often all that's needed. Just ensure that you are not asking the same students to answer. I fall into that trap sometimes. Consider using random name generators. My favorite is Wheel of Names. Check it out, guys. It's really good. Live quiz apps, as I mentioned, such as Blookit, Kahoot, iSpring Quizmaker, and others, are also great ways to frequently check understanding within lessons in real time. When using frequent checks for understanding in your students, it's important to provide feedback to students. Again, feedback's always important. And you see this everywhere throughout Rosenshine's principles, everyone. Feedback is not just one principle on its own. It permeates everything, everything. So providing feedback to students on their performance is really important. This can help them to identify areas where they may need, again, additional support or instruction, and make adjustments to their learning strategies. Additionally, it's important to vary the types of checks for understanding used in your lessons to accommodate different learning needs and abilities. For example, some learners may benefit from diagrams or graphic organizers, while other learners may benefit from class discussions or lectures. And if we're talking about these kind of checks for understanding, we could move from quick quizzes to learning games to a model building, for example, to spatial learning activities. It's important to vary these quick checks for understanding. By using a variety of checks in your lessons and providing regular feedback, you can help your students to develop a deeper understanding of the material and achieve their learning goals more effectively. And for those of you listening who've not read my blog post on deep learning versus surface learning, it's very, very interesting. And I'm not just saying that because I wrote it, although of course I am biased, but I've had a lot of feedback on that blog post, and people have even emailed me to say how useful that blog post was. So do please check that one out. It's linked in the episode description. Number 5, scaffold your instruction. Scaffolding your instruction can help your students learn more effectively. Start with simpler concepts and gradually increase the complexity of the material to help your students build a strong foundation of knowledge. And again, that strong foundation of knowledge is needed by every student to achieve their learning goals. Again, it's all about deep learning, isn't it? Deep learning versus surface learning. And Rosenshine's principles of instruction really do help to facilitate deep learning. Scaffolding your instruction means, yeah, this is a good question. What does scaffolding actually mean? It means breaking down complex concepts into smaller, more manageable pieces that build upon each other. This approach can help students to understand and retain information more effectively by giving them the opportunity to build a strong foundation of knowledge before moving on to more complex material. Scaffolding can take many forms, such as providing students with background information, asking leading questions, or providing step-by-step instructions for completing tasks. By gradually increasing the complexity of the material, students can develop their skills and knowledge in a structured and supportive environment. I think that's a very good summary, because if I think of an example in chemistry, which is a subject I've been teaching for over a decade now, I would scaffold practical skills by first giving students very detailed instructions and demonstrating each step and letting the students do each step after I've demonstrated it and making sure the practical wasn't complex. The next stage of that would be to give the students the instructions and let them do the whole thing on their own. The next stage after that would be to do the same thing, but increase the complexity of the practical. And then the kind of final stage of learning in this whole process is getting students to design their own practicals and manipulate their own variables and come up with their own methods. So that is a natural kind of scaffolding process we go through as science teachers and especially chemistry teachers. And I'm sure you can think of scaffolding, what would you call that? I guess scaffolding timelines that you go through in your subject as you're teaching it. Let's keep going. When implementing scaffolding in your lessons, it's important to keep in mind the needs and abilities of your students. This means providing scaffolding that is appropriate for their level of understanding and adjusting your approach as needed. Additionally, it's important to make sure that scaffolding does not become overly restrictive or limiting for your students. While providing structure and support is important, it's also important to allow students the opportunity to explore and make their own connections between concepts. By striking a balance between structure and flexibility, you can help your students to develop a strong foundation of knowledge, while also allowing them the opportunity to think critically and creatively. Number six, provide feedback. Feedback has its own place in Rosenshine's principles of instruction, but it also permeates everything else you see in these 10 different ways to apply the principles. Feedback is an important component of effective instruction. Provide your students with feedback on their performance, both positive and constructive, to help them improve. I've personally written a lot about feedback in the past, and there's lots that we could explore here. However, if I were to distill the essentials into a few bullet points, they would be as follows. Number one, praise often. See my blog post about the four rules of praise and check out my acclaimed book, The Power of Praise, Empowering Students Through Positive Feedback, for detailed strategies on how to use praise as a tool for rapport building, character building, empowerment, behavior management, and learning. And that book, everyone, has just been submitted to Reader's Favorite for their annual book award contest. So let's see how that does. It already has a 5-star medal from Reader's Favorite. So I'm really hoping that will wow the judges, because it's a very popular book. And I'm getting a lot of very good feedback myself about that book. And if you'd like to purchase it, there's a link in this episode description, no matter where you're hearing this podcast, where you can purchase The Power of Praise, Empowering Students Through Positive Feedback. It's available on Amazon, Books Depository, Abe Books, Blackwell's, Barnes & Noble, everywhere. Number two, state the negatives first, then follow with positives. This is really important, actually, everyone. We've been taught, unfortunately, quite a lot by teacher training colleges to do these kind of 2 stars and a wish methodologies, you know, to praise 2 or 3 things and to come up with fewer things the students have to improve. Actually, what lots and lots of research into human psychology shows is that people tend to respond better when you start with the points for improvement and then finish with the positives. And I use this frequently when I'm giving verbal feedback to my students on their group presentations, for example. I'll start with all the things they could have done better. And then after that, I'll tell them, this was great, your graphics were amazing, and I'll go through the positives. And what it means is that the student leaves that interaction with a very happy vibe about them, and they're more likely to stay motivated to improve further when they leave the interaction in a positive frame of mind than if you've built them up and then you've broken them down by giving positives first and then describing improvement points afterwards. So something to bear in mind. Thirdly, use verbal feedback, but make sure the students take action on what you have said. I think in the educational, pedagogical sphere, it's really not clarified enough that verbal feedback is effective, yes, but only if the students take action on what you've said. And it can be quite a challenge to ensure that students have done that. One technique that I have kind of developed on my own, just out of necessity really, that is working pretty well, is I will give feedback to my students, verbal feedback, maybe in a one-to-one conversation, for example, or when I'm doing live marking. And I will ask my students to write down what I've said. And they have to write the sentence, "Mr. Rogers said," and then follow with what I said about their work. And what this does is it gets the students to, first of all, listen very carefully to what I'm saying, then to process what I've said, and then to delineate it in their notebooks or on their work in some way, in a different colour. It also has the advantage of that when someone comes to scrutinise those books or scrutinise that work, there's feedback in there that the student has written. And it really shows that the student has had to think about the feedback they've been given. It also saves me as the teacher a lot of marking time as well. And that's not out of laziness, because it has the bonus of being actually a lot more efficient and a lot more effective than me as the teacher writing out sentences in the students' notebooks or on the students' work. It's much more effective to get the student to understand the feedback and then write it down. And then, of course, they have to act on it afterwards as well by improving their work. So that's very, very crucial. And finally, use time-saving marking strategies which are efficient and effective. For example, live marking, peer assessment, self-assessment, automated assessment where software marks the work for you. Lots of programs out there that can be used. Number 7, use models and examples. Using models and examples can help your students better understand the concepts you're teaching. Provide your students with examples of how to apply the material to real-life situations to help them make connections. Models and examples can take many forms, such as diagrams, charts, or simulations. By providing students with concrete examples of how a concept works, you can help them to build a mental model of the concept and understand how it can be applied in different situations. Additionally, using a variety of models and examples can help students to see the same concept from different perspectives, which can lead to deeper understanding and better retention of material. Now, this looks different in different subjects. In physics and mathematics, for example, this is really easy. This comes from equations and manipulating equations and changing the subject of different formulae. In geography and history, it might look like viewing a particular situation from a different person's perspective. For example, if you're looking at the Spanish Inquisition in history, you might look at it from the perspective of the Catholics, look at it from the perspective of those who were persecuted, look at it from the perspective of those who had to do the persecuting. You know, that there's many different ways in which you can change the lens through which students view something. And I think teachers have to be quite creative when coming up with these different perspectives. There's also a lot of really good subject-specific ways of doing that in different textbooks for different subjects. You've just got to know how to pick them out. So that's pretty important. Additionally, using a variety of models and examples can help to create deeper understanding. And when using models and examples in your lessons, it's important to choose, again, ones that are appropriate for your students' level of understanding. Providing examples that are too complex can lead to confusion and frustration. Again, while using examples that are too simple could possibly lead to boredom and disengagement. Or examples which are too abstract, which the students just can't relate to. You know, they can't visualize. Here in Thailand, I tend to try my best to use examples that relate to the local demographic. You know, the local geography, local food, local beverages, the customs, the weather that's here, the climate. If I was to describe, for example, braking distance on an icy road in Scotland when it's snowing and there's low visibility, a large portion of my students would never have had that experience. So it might not be the best way to teach that topic or the best example or perspective to use for that particular concept. So it is important that we keep, where possible, the experiences, the lived experiences of our students in mind. Sometimes you may want to provide an experience for your students before using it later to illustrate a point. Something to really think about there. Also, by providing opportunities for active engagement with the material, you can help students to develop a deeper understanding of the concepts being taught. Number 8 of Rosenshine's principles and ways to apply them is to use a variety of instructional techniques. Using a variety of instructional strategies can help keep your students engaged and interested in the material. Use different methods such as lectures, discussions, group work, or hands-on activities to keep your students engaged. Do you know what, everyone? A lot of this can be quite overwhelming, and I understand that. But I will tell you this. I will always remember my first ever lesson at Teacher Training College when I did my PGCE. And I did my PGCE at Bangor University in the UK. Very first lesson. And I remember one of the first things the instructor said. And he said, use variety in your lessons. Use variety. Make sure there's a variety of tasks in your lessons. And I think as a kind of golden rule to follow, I think it's a pretty good one. It's a pretty good one, especially for newly qualified teachers, early careers teachers, teachers who are new to the profession, and even experienced teachers. If you just keep that concept in mind, are my lessons varied? Is there a variety of tasks in this lesson? And if that is the case, you're probably doing the job properly. Your lesson is probably going to be effective if you are using a variety of tasks in your lessons. Now, of course, those tasks have to be relevant and they have to be at the appropriate level. But as long as you've incorporated variety and you've had to think about the tasks you're including in the lessons and you're varying, then I think almost all of the time you're going to be delivering an effective lesson if you just keep that in mind. So I think that's a pretty good one. And I'm glad that Rosenshine agrees with my instructors at Bangor. Let's keep going. Every student has unique strengths, and by using a variety of instructional techniques, you can help to accommodate these differences and ensure that all students are able to engage with the material being taught. Some effective instructional techniques include direct instruction, group work, hands-on activities, and multimedia presentations. Number 9 in my list is one that we all do as teachers, and that is to review and revise. Review and revise your instruction to ensure that you are meeting your students' needs. Regularly assess your students' progress and adjust your teaching methods accordingly. Providing opportunities for regular review is an essential part of effective instruction. Review allows students to reinforce their learning and connect new concepts to previously learned material. It also helps to identify areas where students may need additional support or instruction. Regular review can take many forms, such as quizzes, games, or discussions. By incorporating review into your lessons, you can help to ensure that students are retaining the material being taught and developing a deeper understanding of the concepts. When implementing regular review in your lessons, it's important to provide opportunities for both formal and informal review. Formal review activities, such as quizzes or exams, can help to provide a structured and systematic approach to review. Informal review activities, such as class discussions or games, can be more flexible and allow for more creative and interactive review. Additionally, it's important to provide, again, regular feedback to students on their performance during review activities. This can help them to identify areas where they may need additional support or instruction and make adjustments to their learning strategies. By providing regular review opportunities in your lessons, you can help your students to develop a deeper understanding of the material and achieve their learning goals more effectively. Now, this is an interesting one for me because I think traditionally teachers have been trained to do some kind of plenary at the end of every lesson. And that plenary should in some way be a review of what's been learned that lesson so that the students leave with a good summary and a good refreshment, I guess is a good word, of the concepts that they have learned. But we mustn't forget that a review doesn't just have to happen at the end of a lesson. It can happen at key parts in a lesson as well. Perhaps when you've covered a particular topic or a particular concept, or you've covered a particular exam question which tests a particular skill, for example. So we mustn't forget the importance of formal and informal review. And I think as students get older and they start doing more complex internal and external exams, formal review becomes more important, I think, than informal review. Because if you're preparing, let's say, a group of 16-year-old students to do their IGCSEs or their GCSE exams or whatever end-of-year exam your school has, it's quite important that those students gain exposure to exam-style questions. And I think the one of the best ways to do that is through in-class review time. And that will allow the students to understand command terms and crucially, as well as learning how to write down what they've learned, it will also help students to understand the time constraints of the exam. We call this exam technique, don't we? And some of you may know that the SATs, for example, are becoming completely digital now. They're turning to digital exams. And I think over the next year or two, we can expect a real tidal wave in transition from paper-based written exams, which are mailed to someone, to online digital exams. And to be quite frank, I'm kind of surprised it's taken this long for that to happen. It should have happened over a decade ago. but it's starting to happen now. And it's going to become more important than ever before, I think, that students are given opportunities to formally review the content they've covered in a way that matches the conditions of the exam, especially as exams become more digital. Students are going to need to know how to correctly answer the digital exams, and that's going to require, I think, quite a bit of review in class, formal review. Finally, number 10 in these ways to apply Rosenshine's principles of instruction is provide closure. Very interesting one, this. Probably my favorite of all of them. Provide closure at the end of your lesson to help your students solidify, I love that word, solidify their understanding of the material. Summarize the key points of the lesson and provide your students with an opportunity to ask any remaining questions they may have. Channeling the energy of your students in a healthy and competitive way should be one of the core aims of all plenaries. Reviewing the content and skills learned in class in a fun, competitive, and energetic way can really help with memory and concept retention. Do this consistently each and every lesson and watch your students make tremendous progress as the weeks and months roll by. See my blog post entitled 7 Plenary Activities for PGCE Students and Newly Qualified Teachers for some great ideas for ending your lessons with a fun review of the concepts and skills taught, thereby providing closure. And again, there's a link to that blog post in this episode description. Conclusion. By applying Rosenshine's principles to your lessons, you can help your students learn more effectively and achieve their full potential. Remember to start with a clear objective, use a variety of examples, provide guided practice, use frequent checks for understanding, scaffold your instruction, provide feedback, use models and examples, use a variety of instructional strategies, review and revise, and provide closure. Wow. And I hope that that has provided closure of this podcast episode today. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode. I do value your time immensely. I know that I don't know all of you who are listening, not by any means, but if you've gotten to the end of this podcast episode, you have invested time in the material I've delivered today. So thank you for that. I do hope this has been useful. My advice to anyone who's at this stage of the recording now and listening to me is to, as best as you can, apply these principles. It might be a good idea to actually write down those 10 applications of Rosenshine's that I've talked about today. So one more time, they are: start with a clear objective, use a variety of examples, provide guided practice, use frequent checks for understanding, scaffold your instruction, provide feedback, use models and examples, use a variety of instructional strategies, review and revise, and provide closure. Well, thank you so much, everyone. Check out my blog for teachers, which is becoming very popular now, and that is at richardjamesrogers.com. One more time, that's richardjamesrogers.com. I also offer a public speaking course if you're interested. There's a link in the episode description, and that can be done online as a group class, or even on site if you're here in Thailand, or you want to book me to come to your country to teach you. I can definitely do that as well. So there's a link that you can follow in the episode description. And why not check out my books for teachers, The Quick Guide to Classroom Management and also The Power of Praise. And those are linked in my episode description. Great gifts for newly qualified teachers. Very popular books now, those two. As I mentioned before, they've won a number of awards. And they're also just experience-based as well. You know, those books have come from my own experiences of applying what works best. They're backed by theory, but they're mainly practical-based. Mainly practical-based. And I think that's what teachers need these days. They need strategies that work. I don't think teachers really appreciate abstract frameworks which have tentative connections to what you can actually do in the classroom. And I think it's good when a real teacher like me, who is actually teaching full-time, writes a book that goes through things that actually do work in the classroom. So check out those books. They're linked in the episode description. And that's it for today, everyone. So enjoy the end of this academic year. If you're listening to this episode when I publish it, summer vacation is coming, so rest, recuperate. Our students need us to be fresh when we go back to school in the new academic year. And that's it for today, everyone. So until next time, take care. Bye-bye for now.